This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
It's my distinct pleasure to welcome my next guest, Bill Weir. Bill is a CNN anchor and chief climate correspondent, and he is host and executive producer of the acclaimed CNN original series, The Wonder List with Bill Weir. And now Bill is the author of a wonderful new book entitled Life as We Know It, parentheses can be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. By the way, welcome, Bill.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for your time and congratulations on the publishing of your new book. I was immediately attracted to your book when I read that the book is a series of Earth Day letters to your son to read in 2050. Weaving the worry and the wonder into a reminder to other anxious parents that they are not alone and a better future can still be written. Your concerns for your son's future are the same ones I have for my grandchildren, Luke and Ellie. I worry about what kind of future on this planet our generation is leaving them.
Well, yeah, I can relate to that. And my love to Luke and Ellie, this all was inspired when I became sort of a new old dad at age 52, height of the pandemic, 2020. I had a 16-year-old daughter at the time, and she had influenced the Wonder List, which you kindly mentioned. When I realized she was going to turn my age in the year 2050, I pitched a show to CNN where I'd go to the wonders of the world and see what would be left of them for this next generation when she was my age. And so I used my kids sort of as these living, breathing units of measurement. And when I started covering the climate beat full time, the year 2050 becomes even more poignant. And when I was holding my kid, realizing this kid is going to live to see the 22nd century, and trying to imagine like how energy and food systems and supply chains will evolve in his lifetime, and thinking about the warnings I'd read for science, but also all these incredible innovations that I'd been discovering on this beat. And what started out kind of as a cathartic, angry record of just the seismic events, it was pretty dark, actually, the first couple drafts. But the more time I focused on solutions, the dreamers, the doers, the helpers, as Mr. Rogers taught me to look for when things are scary, the more hopeful the book got. And you know, it started off as sort of a practical guide for him. Where should you live? Where's a climate haven? What kind of house do you build? What kind of food is most sensible to grow given what's coming? And you know, I got into all of that, but then also the psychology of this very complicated story, how we connect to each other, and yeah, it's fun to finally get it out in the world and connect with other folks, dads, granddads, and moms, and share this, because I think so much of the anxiety around this topic is that we don't normally talk about it, we don't bring it up. It's so loaded politically, and I think if we can just change the story a little bit, we can see some really positive change wherever we happen to be.
That's so interesting. You say, what's coming? So what's coming?
Well, you know, the built-in physics of the climate crisis, are the result of 150 years of human progress and the same fossil fuels that made our modern world and really expanded our life spans now is, as I put it in the book, as one sort of scientist fisherman taught me, is we've created this carbon Godzilla. We've unlocked it from the earth. The fuels forever, we just burned whatever was cheap and accessible, from, you know, dung to whales to kerosene and coal, you know, and all of that, the unintended consequences of that, we built this blanket around the planet that is now holding in the equivalent of between 5 and 10 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs per second every day. The oceans absorb most of that. And now, you know, the records that were shattered in 2023 and are continuing to be shattered in 2024, that is baked in. And so we're going to warm up at a scary rate for a while. And that means less predictable water cycles. It means, you know, whiplashing between drought and flood in places. It means strange blizzards in some places and different patterns in other places as the jet stream breaks down. And so I wanted to lay out sort of a clear-eyed assessment of what folks are in for. And of course, this is a slow motion thing, and there will be bluebird beautiful days, and there's so much left to save. It won't be a life of constant apocalyptic catastrophe, but it's going to be a lot tougher for my kid. And he can't take the stuff at the bottom of his pyramid of needs for granted the way I did in terms of air and water and temperature and how to build shelter. And so I'm not a doomsday prepper. I think that we need each other more than anything. And I want my kid to be connected civically and with whatever community he settles in. But I also want him to build a safe community and be, you know, the kind of neighbor who makes his community stronger. And you need to do that with a clear assessment of what's coming. And I was the kind of kid who made fun of Boy Scouts. I loved the outdoors. I loved being out in the woods with just the structure of the discipline and the badges and stuff. And now I'm the dad who's like, be prepared. You know, we will now learn how to read paper maps, and we will now learn, you know, how to talk to strangers and connect with neighbors over shared values around our landscapes. Because I've found the strongest communities, from the blue zones in Greece to South Pacific Islands to Bhutan in the Himalayas, where they measure gross national happiness, these are places where folks are connected with each other and are intimately connected with the nature around them, the seasons, the power. And I'm hoping to inspire a little more of that in our very disconnected, sort of distracted, screen-centered lives, you know?
Yeah, it's the kind of book we kind of need right now. I know you're focusing a bit on what our human needs are that drive us to like imbalance of nature. And then at the same time, you want to inspire communities to galvanize around nature and help each other embrace for what's next. That's really interesting, because it looks like it's going to get bad, but how bad it gets and how we can mitigate and get to a homeostasis that is good for us is all up to us, right?
Exactly. The projections are, to just put it very generally, is that in the next 25 years or so, it's going to feel like we moved 500 miles south, right? And so living in New York City will feel like living in Arkansas in some ways. And living out west, it'll get even more arid in places. And I looked at nature for adaptation techniques. And one I found was that the camel is originally from Canada. That big hump of fat was for blizzards, and those feet and eyelashes were for blizzards. And a few of them wandered across the Bering Land Bridge into Asia, and the North American camel went extinct. But the ones that moved adapted, not just physically, but behaviorally. And so as folks out in very arid cities out west will have to adapt like the camel in ways to cool the cities. Construction may be a graveyard shift job in the future, just because it will be too hot to work outside. There are things that we can mitigate to that, but it's a lot of that is baked in. And so the smart communities get out in front of it. They make sort of rainwater harvesting a point of pride, and xeriscape yards instead of grass are nudged by social cues, right? In the East here, I was up at, I did a story on Salisbury Beach, Massachusetts, right on a barrier island right on the New Hampshire border, where every 10 years or so, the locals would chip in to buy a bunch of sand because the erosion has gotten worse and worse. The storms have gotten worse. This year, they spent $600,000 on 15,000 tons of sand they thought would last them 4 years, and it washed away in a single storm. And now they're wrestling with, what do we do? Can the state help us with $1 million worth of sand to protect these properties? Or do we have to say goodbye to them and talk about managed retreat? These are really tough conversations. And there are communities like that, you know, from Maine to Padre Island, Texas, wildfire country. Everything is currently, I get to see firsthand, being rearranged. Insurance rates, property values. National flood insurance is in trouble. And so I think we need to have these conversations as soon as we can in the communities that rally around each other and get ready and sort of with a clear-eyed view of what they can do to build more resilient communities, even as we try to mitigate the underlying source of the problem. In the end, we'll make ourselves stronger, hopefully better connected. And even in an election year, if we can lean over the fence and say, hey, have you guys thought about our plan? If this happens, if what we just saw in the news happens here, what are we going to do? That's what I'm preaching.
Yeah, I saw where, because of politics, a lot of times the red states don't embrace some of the change, but until they go through maybe a big hurricane or a drought. And then all of a sudden, everybody's an environmentalist. It's kind of interesting.
Totally. Yeah. And everybody is very much in favor of FEMA and national help, federal help
Right.
when you've been hit. Absolutely. But what's interesting, though, and the stories I'm trying to tell, though, too, is at the same time, there has been this incredible burst of energy in terms of earth repair investment, billions and billions of dollars pouring into clean energy to both sources, storage like thermal batteries, which store all this abundant heat or all this abundant sun and wind energy that is now online, can store it hopefully big enough to run factories. And the economics of this right now, Kevin, most people don't know, makes Texas the greenest state in the union.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
The three of the top five green states for wind and solar are Republican supermajority states, and Texas has their own grid. And a few Sundays ago, electricity was free for 6 hours because, the sun was blazing and the winds were howling. And now there's going to be a race to catch all of that and hold on to it and run factories. And it could rearrange industrial belts in this country. And, when we talk about the climate story, which I think touches every part of our lives, and people will appreciate more and more as time goes by, so much of it has been framed as either doom or sacrifice. And Dr. Martin Luther King didn't say, "I have a nightmare." He said, I have a dream to get people motivated and united around something. And I don't think we talk enough about the dream of building systems, because of our health and our wealth and happiness is directly dependent on a planet and a climate imbalance. Now, with our innovation, if we could build systems that make us healthier and wealthier and happier, even as these physical changes around us happen, we at least can shoot for that.
So, it seems like we need some speed in this equation and also scale.
We do.
How do we get the majority of everybody saying, hey, we really want to do this, almost like maybe what Biden's doing with the economy and putting so much money into some of these technologies you're talking about? What are you thinking about that? I mean, how do these communities come together on a grand scale and say, do the moonshot?
Yeah, I think, you could start with your utility, practically. Most folks didn't appreciate, I certainly didn't appreciate, that in our free market, quote unquote, capital system or competition rules, our utilities are against capitalism in every possible way. They're legalized monopolies in which they're incentivized, they're guaranteed a certain customer base and at a certain rate. And their only incentive is to build much more expensive infrastructure so they can raise rates. And so the people who sit on your public utility commission board or who are at the levels of those powers, sometimes they're elected, sometimes they're appointed. But I argue that getting way more invested in that election will have much more impact, not just locally, but globally, than maybe even the national election where you happen to live. That's important too. But I think that what I'm seeing is the country balkanizing is a crass term to put on it, but there are states that are leaning into, as I said, the clean energy transition. There are states like Montana that are leaning into fixing the housing demand by basically not wanting to be California. They outlawed single family housing, which leads to sprawl and segregation. They want dense urban centers in places like Bozeman, so people aren't building suburbs, out on the scenic vistas of Montana. The smartest ideas for building these sort of holistic, sustainable communities are going to be more and more attractive and will be magnets, I think, that will create movement, I hope. There's a community called Babcock Ranch I write about in the book in Florida. And it's about 15 miles inland from Punta Gorda, where I wrote out Hurricane Ian, and most of the counties around me just were flooded and plunged into darkness for weeks. But this is the first solar town in America. Never lost power. They watched the hurricane like on TV as it
Very
blew
cool.
over them and never flooded because the developer, a guy named Sid Kitson, a former NFL lineman, was an environmentalist and wanted to prove that you could build with nature. And so he looked at the flood patterns and the natural flows and built around it, didn't try to conquer it. And they never flooded. And instead of becoming you know, like their neighbors, just miserable and in the dark, they were this refuge, a haven of light and power, and were able to help the linemen, you know, feed them and do their laundry and take in folks from the storm who'd lost their homes. And now that that's a proof of concept we can point to, and you don't have to ask folks to imagine a better future that's there, the line to get in there is years long now. And Sid is building as many homes as he can. And I think that we're on the cusp of that taking off. I think the communities that can afford it will make the investments. I worry about those who can't, you know. But again, I think COVID taught us that the communities that trusted each other and rallied around each other suffered the least. And because this is more of a slow motion disaster, and it feels like, for even in some people's minds, it's far off, it's decades off, that now's the time. Now's the time to hunker down when the skies are still relatively clear.
We're talking to CNN anchor and chief climate correspondent Bill Weir. Happy to have him here. You know, I do an e-news headlines feature called Guygram on this radio station, and sometimes I get accused of a little bit too many negative stories, which happen to be flooding towards me constantly. So I always balance it with some positive stories too, because I really do see a lot of stuff going on that gives me hope. There's lots of groups, lots of people doing things, you know, imitating nature and farming and gardening and things like that. And that's really important, I think, for the future. So what things have you seen and are reporting in your book that can give us some optimism? Or are you a pessimist?
No, well, yeah, absolutely. You nailed it with the focus. Like, you have to, the canvas is so big that we're looking at, you know, that you can focus. I can go dark as with the best of them.
Right.
And like I said, the early drafts, I was supposed to turn this book in 2 years ago. I'm glad it didn't, because enough had changed, enough policy had changed, and new investment and all of that. And then when you sort of follow that, you feed that wolf, you know, your curiosity for solutions, you find another one and another one. But I'm most excited of, like, these ideas that seem so simple to me that never occurred to me, like a thermal battery, which was invented probably by the first caveman who moved a hot rock from near the fire to where he was sleeping. But it's a way to store, like I was talking about, all this abundant solar and wind power in the form of heat. And I profiled a company called Antora Energy, started by this public school kid out of Oregon who was just obsessed with the climate problem and solutions, got into solar, recruited to drop out of Stanford to go run a major solar company. And then when he came back to school, he realized storage was the key and looked at all different ways to do it, from pumping water underground to pressurized rock and then you release it, or, you know, pump storage where you pump water uphill and you let it run down through water wheels, you know, everything you could look at to store renewable energy, and settled on thermal batteries, which are giant blocks of carbon, which are super common and cheap. They're used to melt or smelt aluminum and stuff, make pencil lead, like really, you know, graphite. You put that about the size of a semi-tractor trailer or, you know, shipping container. You build a box around it. Heat that thing up to 2,500 degrees, enough to melt steel, to make steel or run a factory. And then they figured out you could use that heat, not just with liquid, move it with liquid, but you could crack open the box like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And the light that comes beaming out, you catch with another solar panel. And he's already has customers running factories off of wind in the Midwest. And I went to one where he's running it off of solar. But Con Edison in New York City, which has been making steam that you see in New York City movies, which, you know, serves like 3 million people with dirty fuels for 100 years, that could be in the mix for them. And so the idea that my little boy's New York City steam will be made by a hot rock in a box, you know, heated up by a turbine off a Long Island somewhere, is cool to me. It's also people who come up with ideas to build stronger homes, more better insulated homes. The kind, you know, I grew up in construction, working in the summers, we built homes with skinny walls and giant furnaces and air conditioners. That's changing. And passive house construction is really exciting to me. The idea that you could build a home that's so cozy, but is just so well insulated that it warms itself by the heat of the bodies inside or the appliances. And then I meet people who are just role models of resilience, from the wildfires in Maui to folks in Paradise who survived that fire and rebuilt. You know, again, it's resignation and preparation for what's built in, and trying to be as smart as we can about that, but also trying to stay hopeful and really engaging folks. And I argue that if we connect with each other around the bottom of the pyramids of needs, the food and shelter, the safety needs, that it'll fill the higher needs, the love and esteem needs that we crave and try to fill with, you know, yoga retreats and likes on social media. But the more I look around and the more you realize like-minded folks connecting, as you said, like, oh, and the other one is, and I know you love digging in the dirt, so you love the regenerative agriculture piece. I found was new research out of comparing, you know, cattle and ranch operations, neighbors across the same fence in the Southeast. They did a 4-year study and found that those who graze their cows more like the buffalo and let their pastures recharge and never have to fertilize or cut for hay, their farms are drawing down more carbon, retaining more rainfall, moisture, bringing back more biodiversity and microbes and bird life. And it's just a simple hack that actually gives more time to the farmer in the end and allows them to double herd size. So conversations around all meat is evil that have no nuance, I think, need to fade away. Conversations that this is the fuel source of the future need to fade away. It is going to be not a silver bullet, but buckshot, Kevin, that of a million different ideas that can improve every sort of aspect in our lives, 10, 15% in the near term, maybe, but added up, that's a big deal, you know? Sure. And so those are the conversations I'm hoping to spark.
So you have a 20-something daughter, and there's all kinds of reporting that under that age group, there's quite a bit of worry and, you know, about climate, and they're feeling anxious and sad and angry and most of all powerless. You know, it seems like it's just passing them by and they want something done. Do you address that in the book?
I do. I sort of address the early chapters to my little boy River, because, you know, he helps me think about that lifespan of when he's old enough for a mortgage and what'll happen by then. Late in the book, when I get into it's framed around Maslow's pyramid of needs and reassessing those in the age of climate change. And in the towards the end, I address it to my daughter Olivia, because one of my deep regrets, and I talk about it in this chapter, is giving her an iPhone and teaching her to use Instagram when she was 10 years old. I was covering tech at ABC News at the time, and this was brand new. And she was born on my birthday in 2003, and I got my first iPod that year, you know, and became sort of an Apple consumer like so many. And so on her 10th birthday, it seemed fitting she would get her first phone. Anyway, now we know that I just gave her an anxiety machine, you know, that was just pumping some of the worst of experiences full time into her life, and not teaching her how to manage it, not teaching her the importance of in real life communication and community, and how easy you can self isolate with these machines now. And I scold myself. I became super addicted to Twitter, just in my job. It was a way to do research and engage, but I got way too into it. I was using it to fill love and esteem needs instead of the, you know, basic job needs. I do address that generation in that we're sorry. I mean, this letter is sort of a letter of an apology for breaking their sea and sky. But it's also a rallying cry. And in the words of my dad, when I complained, would say, good thing you're tough. And so what about the problem? So what next? What are we doing next about this? And trying to instill them with a sense of agency and a reminder that the same social media, you know, it's a tool that can, like a knife or a blade, can be used to heal or rob you, or burn your house down. Social media, now AI, these are tools that if used to gather around a common cause bigger than yourselves, the way the Fridays for Future movement, Greta Thunberg led it. I don't think the most ambitious climate legislation in U.S. history gets passed and signed without those kids in the streets and camping out in the halls of the Senate and yelling down the corridors of power. And it's harder to see now. There was actually some demonstrations leading up to Earth Day, but used that way, they absolutely need to know their agency. And as I hope I'm trying to teach my daughter her agency, not just as a voter, a member of her community, but as a consumer, the brands, you know, that she likes. And an email to their customer relations matters, if that's the least you can do, or at least try to reward the brands you think are doing the right things. But then it's a case of that generation asks, what can I do? What are you good at? What do you love? Because this touches so many facets of life that if you're good with numbers, you could probably help out a nonprofit, saving a bird you like. Or if you're good at going to meetings and sharing what's happening with your community, and you want to get plugged into that utility board, figuring out what's happening there, do that. You know, so I empathize with the generation. I can see the motivation that comes behind stuff like when they glue themselves to artwork or whatever, that direct action, which inevitably comes with a backlash. But they're having to sort all this out because a lot of the adults in their lives aren't talking about it in a sensible way. And the more we all talk about this issue and all kick in our ideas and start where we can, I think that the better mental health will come for all of us. And then self-care is earth care ultimately.
Yeah, that's what I do. I mean, I have my daughter is, you know, and her husband, they're in their late 30s, and they're dealing with my grandchildren and how to deal with screens and time in the environment. You know, get out. We try to take them out. Let's go catch some frogs, you know, or let's go feed the turtles at the local park, or walk the beach or something that's not screens. And then help us out in the garden too, because we're big gardeners, and you could plant a tomato plant, or, you know, whenever they were planting stuff, they get out and do it. So that's what we have to, I think, books like yours preach that positiveness to try to, you know, change what the modern world has offered us, which can be problematic.
Yeah. And make it part of the, I'm trying to make it part of the family. You know, I'm not, again, a lot of the stuff I'm preaching is aspirational. You know, I'm living in Brooklyn in a city, in a building with a D rating, you know, in terms of energy. And I wish I had a garden. I don't have a cabin out in the woods like I did before, but plan to, and just trying to, foster that curiosity in them. Where their food comes from, you know, where their water comes from, and maybe use those screens and indoctrinate them with a little nature shows. Like my kid can't get enough of that, you know, but also on connecting the dots that it's not just a movie, that this is real life. And these guys live out there, and just the way we, our wildlife around here. And the sooner we can connect those dots, I think the better.
All right. So as you're the chief climate correspondent in the network news, CNN, what is your take on the way the networks report the weather and major destructive weather events? I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but do you think our weathermen and women are doing enough in connecting the dots to climate breakdown and say like a beautiful warm day in December that's 50 degrees? You know, I mean, you know, they're always so happy it's warm.
Exactly.
What's your thoughts about this?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think about it a lot for obvious reasons, but the topic has been so politically charged and demagogue for so long. And because your local meteorologist really has a hard-won relationship with the audience and, you know, of all political stripes, I totally understand that you just the facts about today's weather. And if you want to try to connect this to bigger patterns globally, you're stepping into a few phone calls at the minimum, you know, to the station switchboard, right? So there's a natural resistance to that. I think that's changing. It depends on the station. It depends on leadership. But what I like to say is the way everybody became a health reporter during COVID and suddenly had to bone up on virology, we're all going to be climate reporters sooner or later. And this is the beat that touches all others. You know, I resisted being pigeonholed with a beat. I was a generalist. I was an anchor. And then when we decided to create a climate desk, proud to be at a place that cared about it like that, then you realize, wait, this includes all the other beats. It is geopolitics and foreign policy and economics and healthcare and shelter and transportation. All have various climate angles to them. And everybody in the newsroom should be emboldened to talk about that as it affects their beat as they see it. And I'm not precious about the story. So I'm trying to spread the wealth. And I'm the guy generally yelling at my competitors, we do a much better job, I'm proud to say, at CNN, but it takes a while to break the muscle memory. I'm the guy yelling at the TV, say it, say the word climate, when somebody is doing a live shot from, you know, the wildfire smoke, you know, that made Manhattan look like Blade Runner, you know, like connect the dots between this air we can now see and the pollution we can't, that's supercharging these fires. If you're doing a hurricane, costliest hurricane in Florida history story, you got to talk about how warmer ocean temperatures are the engines
sure
of hurricanes. And historically, just look at the trend. And so, and if you're doing this story about, we just set another record for the hottest month ever, of March ever, whatever month it is, you know, I try to remind the audience that this is also one of the coolest Marches for the rest of our lives, because we think in our brains, our Homo sapien brains have these, can't think in these long timescales. It's just human nature to think, wow, that was a really rough storm. Dodge that one. Glad there won't be another one like that for another century, you know. And unfortunately, the Goldilocks Earth that we all grew up on, we've already shifted out of that. And we're not sure how this new one works yet. And because there's always something more urgent on the day of, you know, a long-term climate trend story seems more disposable. And it's always in the background, and there's no satisfying season finale to it, you know. So it's a tough story to tell sometimes, but
sure.
I'm trying.
I'm of the mind that I don't think we're going to see a significant public outcry and to do things about the situation unless there's some major weather events that sort of pummel us. And like, yeah, let's say if Florida gets hit with three Category 5 hurricanes successively, that may turn people's minds around. It's sort of like the Ministry for the Future book that Stanley Robinson wrote. There was a major event in that book that sort of spun people's heads around and said, wow, oh, we really do have a problem. What do you think?
Yeah, I know. That was, he used a heat wave in India that kills over 1 million people, and that spurs them into, you know, geoengineering, trying to spray sunscreen in the sky. And that's the thing that's so pervasive about this kind of disaster, is it's always localized. You know, when there's a heat dome up in British Columbia and it's hotter than Vegas has ever been, and is killing 1 billion sea creatures and killing seniors in their homes with no air conditioning, it's like a beautiful day in Dallas, right? And the weatherman on the air in Dallas is not talking about this apocalypse up in Vancouver, right? And there's only, I just happened to do this because I was focused on this because we were doing so much of the eclipse coverage. But the two disasters that can shut down all global commerce at once, if you study all the people who care about this stuff, it is a global pandemic, or it would be a solar storm that sends a pulse of energy, you know, that fries the grids and knocks satellites from the sky. Weather events, as bad as things get, it'll be beautiful postcard day somewhere on that same day somewhere else. And so it's easy to just say, well, those poor suckers, they had a rough string of luck, but we're fine here, you know, without connecting the dots about how their fate is completely intertwined with mine. And it's just a matter of how it will manifest itself.
You know, you mentioned the COVID thing, but wasn't it remarkable how quickly nature rebounded when we all stayed in the house? It was,
exactly.
I mean, it was this, you know, the pollution went down. It was like amazing.
Oh, you got it. You know what? There was a new study, Kevin, that just came out that was shocking, where they looked at lifespans actually go up during recessions, because the working folks who breathe in the pollution next to the factories, you know, that lessens and it extends their lives. So, yeah, that is another thing that gives me hope, is that nature can rebound unbelievably well. New York Harbor is proof of that, right? You know, when I was the Hudson River is an open sewer. We had a humpback whale chase at, you know, School of Menhaden within a mile of Times Square a couple years ago. The life has come back so much that they've had to reinforce all of the pilings at Brooklyn Bridge Park, because shipworms are now back, you know, can now live in this water again. It's, you know, if we get out of the way, the regenerative nature of this earth is staggering.
I agree with you. So let's finish up here with, we're asking our contributors and our listeners to tell us their thoughts about Earth Day. What do you want to say about Earth Day?
I think it's both an inspiring day for me, that it's a reminder of how bad things were in the 70s and the 60s and 70s when I was a baby, when you could see the pollution in LA like it was a dirty fishbowl. You could see the rivers on fire in Ohio. You could see the bald eagles dying. And it galvanized this movement along with pictures of our blue marble from space and reminded us of our connection to Earth. But I'm also frustrated that we think, you know, one day is enough. If you only loved your mother on Mother's Day, that would be horrible for both of you. And so, yeah, I am. And I think we've come a long day from those early Earth Day rallies in Central Park where there was mountains of trash left afterwards. I think we're more conscious, I guess, eco-conscious of our choices. But if it is a way for people to connect and talk about these issues, I'm all for it. And I hope people, you know, use it to do just that.
Well, my guests have been Bill Weir, a CNN anchor, chief climate correspondent, and author of a wonderful new book called Life as We Know It Can Be, Stories of People, Climate, and Hope in a Changing World. Bill, thank you for coming aboard here.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.